Sometimes God uses crises or stressful events to get our attention. Have you noticed that? Sometimes it's when we're neck deep in trouble that we finally cry out and invoke the name of God. That's when we seem to call out to God for help. I mean, just take a look at the headlines that we've had this past week. It's filled with people who've been in trouble of various sorts and of various depths of trouble. From our premier having to cancel yoga on Burrard Bridge, which was just a publicity nightmare for her, to prolific scientists making sexist comments in the guise of a joke. Boy, and he's had to resign his post. And he was a Nobel laureate, too, by the way, so he's a leading scientist. Leaders being caught in a web of lies. Just down in Washington State, we've had the leader of the NAACP, who apparently is not black, but has been living that, trying to misrepresent who she is. And there's a whole other story of what we've only begun to hear about. What about to police officers also being scrutinized for brutality? And that's been a running storyline in the South, in the States, and more recently just in Texas. For us, more for us locally, it might be a health concern. It might be a scary diagnosis. It could be a broken relationship. It could be a lost spouse. Once we've had the chance to realize that we're utterly powerless in the situation, we call out to God for help. And I'm wondering if we can relate to any of these situations. The interesting thing is that here in the book of Jonah, God listens. He offers no judgment. He doesn't finger point, or he doesn't shame Jonah. And I'm wondering sometimes, like Jonah, the circumstances that we sometimes find ourselves in, if they're more often than not sometimes punishment for the choices that we've made, and we're left to live with the consequences of our decisions. Sometimes that's enough. Eugene Peterson says, the belly of the fish is a place of confinement, and Al alluded to that. It's of severe and inescapable limits. In other words, you're kind of stuck there. You can't move. And it's almost a forced time of self-reflection. Now, the interesting thing is some of you have shared with me that your health scare or dire circumstances was one of the best things that has ever happened to you in your life. That was surprising for me. The inescapable circumstances wake us up to what's really important, right? The reality of our lives, the fragility of life, and how beautiful it is. It opens us up and wakes us up to the importance of family and friends, and maybe even to the importance of God in our lives. So instead of focusing upon ourselves and our plight, we're forced to actually look at what's really important. Success and money and happiness are, as important as they are, suddenly aren't at the forefront of our thoughts and our minds. Now, regardless, at that moment in time, God's certainly got our attention. We're ready to listen. He's got us in the palm of his hand, so to speak. And I think that's exactly what Jonah could relate with in today's passage. So if you haven't yet turned into today's passage, I invite you to do so now. Turn with me to Jonah. Go from chapter 1 at the very end of that, and you can just skim along as we talk about it. Now, in chapter 1, we met Jonah last week, and we learned that he was a prophet, and he was a prophet on the run. He was intended to bring a message of doom, actually, to a people who God wasn't happy with. And he said, you know what? I don't want to go there because I know what you're going to do, God. You're going to show them grace, and I don't like that. I want you to, blow him up. So he heads the other way. And he hightails it. And ironically, we learn that God uses all sorts of circumstances to bring glory to himself, even when we're not interested in doing his will. And so the sailors wind up worshiping God as they witness the seas calm down after they've thrown Jonah overboard. And as Jonah drowns, sinking down into the depths of the dark waters, he is saved by God in a miraculous way. God commands, with one word, a great fish to swallow Jonah whole. The important thing isn't the type of fish this was or the plausibility. The important part of this whole narrative is that God saves despite what Jonah might have deserved. God exercises grace and compassion. And once again, our passage begins by declaring that God is the creator of all things with just but a word. He commands a fish. The sailors tried as hard as they could to get to shore to offload Jonah so the seas would calm down, but just with one word, he commands this fish. God is the creator of all things, so all things are under his command, including great fish, including the storms and the seas. God is supreme. Now, Jonah's been saved from a watery grave, and it is here that we encounter Jonah in his three dark nights of the soul, as St. John of the Cross might say. Here's the interesting part. To really understand Jonah's prayer of thanksgiving, which is what we see in chapter 2, we have to understand the Hebrew worldview and the symbolism of the sea and the deep and the flood. And we also have to understand a little bit of the Old Testament conception of what death is. So we're just going to touch on that just briefly. According to the portrayal of the world in Genesis 1 and throughout the scriptures, the universe was three-storied, okay? It was like a three-layer cake. Heaven was above, earth was in the middle, and Sheol, the place of the dead, was under the earth. This wasn't called hell, it was Sheol, the place of the dead. The earth was understood to float on underground waters. And the earth was anchored by pillars or mountains. And below these deep waters lay the realm of the dead, otherwise known as Sheol. And it's kind of described here in a cartoon diagram. Now, the Hebrew mind understood that the waters under the earth were not ordinary waters, like you and I would understand them. They were the waters of the primeval deep, waters that were out of the chaos, right? The waters that were bound when God created the world. So in the Hebrew mind, these waters were somewhat evil. They were dark, and they represented death. They're uncontainable. And God, in Genesis 1, contains it. He brings order to creation. And he harnesses these waters and puts them under the earth. So the waters were opposed. They were set in contrast to God's order, his goodness, their dark, his light, their death, his life. So that all these things were contrasted. So for the Hebrew mind, the waters and Sheol was dark. It represented death and evil. So to sink into the waters was to sink into the deep, into the dark, into death, but into evil. And the realm of Sheol, or the Psalms would call it the pit. And it was, as it was sometimes called in Psalm 69, Psalm 124, Psalm 144. Take a look at today's passage now. Go with me in the text. Go to verses 3 to 5. Jonah is cast into the sea by the sailors, and the chaotic waters are closing around him as he sinks towards Sheol. Now in verse 2, the TNIV uses the words realm of the dead. That's Sheol. It's where all the dead went. It's described throughout scriptures as a place of darkness in Job, of dust in Psalms, and from where there is no return, again, in Job. And where life is but a shadow and the shades, the spirits just chirp and they mutter. That's found in Isaiah. There was no return from Sheol, okay? And so in verse 6, Jonah will be imprisoned by the bars of the land. Now, the bars of the land, that doesn't mean the earth as the TNIV has it. Job will be imprisoned in the land of Sheol. This is a little bit more harsh. This is what the Hebrew mind would have understood about the deep, dark waters. Worse yet, when you think about Sheol, Yahweh could not be worshipped in Sheol, and you'll see that in Psalm 6 or Psalm 88 if you want to take a look at that. So Jonah will be driven out from Yahweh's presence forever, and that's why he says that in this passage, and will never again be able to look forward to Yahweh's dwelling in heaven or on earth. In verse 4, Jonah is sinking towards death. So we've got this picture. He's sinking, and he's separated from God. And in Hebrew thought, every sort of distress or illness or trouble was also considered to be a weak form of death. So while Jonah is not yet dead, he can say that he has been in Sheol, and yet Yahweh has delivered him from there in verse 6. So in a very short span of verses here, suddenly Jonah is delivered. And he recognizes that in this prayer of thanksgiving. God rescues Jonah with this great big fish. And he finally prays in verses 2 and 4 and 7 that God, he's finally heard his prayer. Verse 7. But how ironic is that? That Jonah criticizes those who rely on worthless idols in verse 8. Until the time of this prayer, Jonah has not relied on Yahweh at all. But now as he's sitting in the dark, in the damp belly of a great fish, he has realized his dependence is completely upon God for his life. And he himself has to confront his own idolatry of self-sufficiency or pride. And the question that we need to ask ourselves in reflection of this passage is, what idols do we cling to even while in that dark, smelly place of crisis? What are the things that we're unwilling to let go of while we're in deep distress? Jonah does finish his prayer with a vow to give a thanks offering. And so we know already when he says this prayer that things are going to turn out well for him. And that's an appropriate response, a thanks offering. However, the funny thing is, the difficulty with this song of thanksgiving is that it is sung while he is yet still inside this great fish. Remember, he's there for 72 hours, 3 days. Jonah has been delivered from Sheol's death, but he is still inside the fish. So he's still in a tight spot, so to speak. In one way, this Thanksgiving song marks a conversion of Jonah of sorts, because we'll see later as we read into the book that he's not fully converted. He still has a bone to pick with God. But for now, Jonah has turned to God, and the result is that the Lord speaks just a word to the fish, and the fish promptly vomits Jonah out onto dry land. And when you hear the word, the fish vomits Jonah onto dry land, what might come to mind? In my mind, I was thinking about some of the words in Revelation where God talks about vomiting someone else out, because I don't want someone who is lukewarm. I want something either hot nor cold. It's no good if it's lukewarm, right? So some of these images come to mind as we read this passage. And back in chapter 1, the sailors couldn't reach the dry land to get rid of Jonah, but one little word from Yahweh gives both Jonah and the fish, relief. Can you imagine how the fish might have felt being stuck with this person? Cannot digest this food he's eaten. It's kind of like something's sitting poorly in my stomach, right? I love how Elizabeth Achtermeyer wrote. She's a theologian. She says, 3 days of undigested Jonah. Can you imagine how that must have felt? Here's a few thoughts about Jonah's prayer today, and then we'll conclude. First, Jonah's prayer warns us of spiritual superficiality. That is to say, spiritual shallowness. I fear that shallow spirituality is the norm in our culture. It might be in my life, and I wonder if any of ours as well. It has many telltale symptoms here. It relies on the wrong things, such as background, where you come from, ancestry, denomination or status, knowledge, job title, amount of time we give or amount of money that we give, maybe even simply that we go to church versus someone who doesn't. It's heavy on form, this shallow spirituality. It mimics rather than is genuine. It prays only in dire circumstances. Is your prayer life characterized only by the times that you're in crisis? I hope it isn't. It's inward and self-centered. Mine has been of recent, rather than God-focused or others-minded. It is insensitive to the needs and concerns of others, yet it lets everyone know of its own needs. It looks over one's own sin while at the same time points out the sin in others. And it lacks intimacy with God and has little evangelistic desire. And it tends to distort doctrine and gives excuses for personal sin. And I think this is where Jonah was, especially while he was reflecting in this fish for 3 days. So we need to be aware of spiritual shallowness. Second, we are reminded that God's method of saving us is not always the method that we would have chosen. How many of us would have thought, you know, God, that's great. You used a big fish to swallow Jonah and save him. Like, that's the last thing I would have thought. You know, maybe he would have sent another fishing boat that was in the area, a big military boat maybe, that would have been able to help him out. But God sends this big fish. Who would have thought? Jonah would have much preferred a dramatic search effort, right? He would have maybe wanted the Coast Guard, helicopters, skin divers, and then, of course, he would have wanted television coverage, right? He would have wanted to be on the news and maybe and get an interview with Jimmy Fallon on the late night show after he left the hospital, though. I wonder if God did not choose to do it this way because one of Jonah's main struggles was with his own pride. He felt a lot better than the Ninevites, and he thought the Ninevites deserved death. While in the meantime, Jonah was the one who faced real death, right? It's almost as if God was saying, Jonah, you know what? What the Ninevites deserve, you're getting. But you know what? What you deserve is death. But I'm giving you grace, and that's what I want to show the Ninevites. Are you tracking with me, Jonah? I want to share grace. But God doesn't stop there. Take a look at verse 10. With but a word, Jonah is vomited up onto the beach. And then let's move to chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. Let's take a look at that. After Jonah has had his time out, as Wesley would say, and he endured the consequences of trying to run away from God, God recommissions Jonah, right in verse 1. And in verse 3, Jonah finally does what God originally asks of him. Isn't that interesting? There isn't a sitting down, okay, Jonah, let's have a talk about this. I'm going to tell you the three ways that you really ticked me off today. I'm just going to make you feel how I felt. That's sometimes how I feel with my kids. You know, let me sit you down. When you said the way you did, this is the way it made me feel. God doesn't do that to Jonah. God just says, okay, Jonah, I want you to get up again and go to Nineveh. He doesn't give him a tongue lashing. He recommissions Jonah, and Jonah finally does what he was asked to do. Here's the take home for today. If there's nothing else you remember about today's message, I want you to take this home. God is about redemption. God is about grace. He is about giving people second chances. And I'm not just talking about the Ninevites. I'm talking about even Jonah. That's us, brothers and sisters. We're the ones who think that we're God followers. We're the ones who think that we're saved and we're secure in that. And yet how often has God asked us to do something, and we say, you know what, God, I'm going to go to Tarshish. I'm going to go the other way, because I don't want to do what you're asking me to do. And God says, you know what, I know the plans I have for you. Thank you, Cheryl, for that. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you. But if I'm going to have to trap you in a fish, just so you can think about it for a minute and have a time out, I might have to do that. I wonder if that is indeed what we ask God to do. Lord, protect me from all things. We say that on a daily basis. But we forget that God also wants to protect those who don't know him. I think God asks his children to, like he, show grace and compassion and redemption and forgiveness. And sometimes we forget to do those things. This past week's news has been filled with failures. But as I reflected upon these news highlights, I thought to myself that these failures were also missed opportunities by our culture in general. I raised the story of Corporal Eric Casebolt of Texas. He was recorded on video that went viral last week, pushing a black girl to the ground at a pool party and acting out of control at the scene of the crime. He was called to respond to some fights that are happening at a pool, and there was a disturbance there. And so, to his credit, he responded to that call. To his discredit, he overreacted. Now, to put things in perspective, there were a lot of teenagers about, and he was being charged from behind. So what would have I done in that situation? I would have felt threatened and maybe pulled my sidearm as well. I don't know. The fact of the matter is, in this day and age, everyone has a phone and everyone has a camera on that phone, and his actions, for good or ill, were recorded. And that went viral. In the context of the United States, where there is such racial friction, for lack of a better term, this was just incendiary. It was ready to be a powder keg. And as a result, Casebolt resigned from the McKinney Police Department after almost 10 years of on the force. So he was a veteran. Here's a response from the blog of Eugene Cho. He's a pastor in Seattle, and I've just really begun really appreciating some of his writing, some of his reflections upon this. He says this: Officer Casebolt ought to have been suspended for an indefinite time. That is to be true. That is without a doubt. But what if we had room and space for redemption? And this is where it gets interesting. I really appreciate what he has to say here. As Christians in particular, a gospel story without redemption is a broken and bankrupt theology of the gospel. Isn't that true? God is in the business of restoring broken and fallen people. Right? Jonah is case in point. We are case in point. Take Nineveh, for example. Cho continues, I need to believe that for all of us, that we are not defined by our very worst mistakes. In other words, the beauty of redemption for you and for me and for all of us is the hope in knowing that Christ is not yet done with us. He's in the business of making us more like him, and that takes time. In the same way that many are rightly and prophetically calling for a more dignified storytelling of all peoples, we must have the courage to believe this for others. There's always more sides to the story than what we see. For all of us. Meaning, is it possible for us to vilify and demonize Officer Casebolt in such a way that it's not justice we're seeking, but actually retribution, masked under the guise of justice? Do we believe that redemption and reconciliation is actually possible? Now, clamoring for reconciliation with justice is lacking, but so is seeking justice without hope for reconciliation. So I think that's something that we need to aim for as a culture. In other words, and this is something that NCC does well and continues to try to do, what does restorative justice look like? And I echo Eugene Cho's words. My hope for the church and for our larger society is to be bent not just for the clamoring and demanding of swift justice, but in imagination for restorative justice. In my mind, that's a biblical justice. Can you imagine a story where Officer Casebolt is indeed suspended, but during this time of suspension, he's invited to undergo extensive counseling and additional training? What if the victim, this black girl who was thrown down by him, what if her family were willing, since she should not feel obligated to engage in this process? What if, though, she was willing, and the family was willing to engage? Can we imagine if Officer Casebolt willingly went to her and to her family and truly apologized to her face to face? In this case, he's walked away from it all, and he hasn't been given that opportunity. He hasn't taken that opportunity to say, you know what? What I did was wrong. I overreacted. I'm sorry. Instead, he's resigned, and case is closed. Have we ever seen a police officer, after a situation like this, apologize to the said person? I'm still waiting for the RCMP to respond to that Polish fellow who they tasered at the airport and killed, and say, we made a grave mistake. We are terribly sorry. They are still trying to say, you know what? We're trying to wipe our hands off this. How does that mom feel that justice has not been done? Can we imagine if these families, both the police officers' families and the victims' families, got together for dinner? What would that look like? Can we imagine the impact that would have on the communities in Richmond, in the Polish community, in our community? It would say something, wouldn't it? What we need in the world isn't just more of our version of justice, which might feel right for a short term, but we need a glimpse of restorative justice that merges the biblical invitation and command of Micah 6:8, which is seek justice, love kindness, walk humbly. And this is what God was inviting Jonah to do as he went into Nineveh. It is indeed hard to imagine restorative justice in our world. But we need a fresh vision. We need a beginning point, a place to start, and that begins with some of the wrongs that have been committed. And it takes strength and courage and humility to be the one who initiates that as someone who's offended someone else. So, brothers and sisters, join me. I invite you to join me in doing that as we begin in our own homes. When we've offended our spouse, our friend, our life mate, our child, let's begin there. And let's move outward. This is one of the stories of Jonah. God is a God of grace and second chances. He is not a God of retribution. And if we look closely at the life of Jesus, this is the vision and imagination that he offers to us. Let us continue praying, brothers and sisters. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thanks be to God. I'm going to close with prayer as the worship team comes forward. And we'll end with song, and then we're going to invite you to join us downstairs. And Nola and Ron, would you lead us in the doxology so we can pray for the food after your last song? That be possible? God, you are a God of grace, and we thank you for that. We thank you that you believe in us, sometimes when we even don't believe in you. Thank you for your determination to redeem those who don't deserve anything. Thank you for your deep love of creation, and that includes us. Help us to be agents of your mercy, of your forgiveness. In your name we pray. Amen.